Good morning, everyone, and Andy, thank you very much for the invitation to join you today. It's really good to see the tradition of AusPayNet's annual summit continue, even if this year it's taking a different form. So thank you for the invitation to be here once again. As we all know, the world of payments has become an era of excitement. It brings together two things that people have a fascination with. Those two things are money and technology. The pace of change is rapid, and the payments landscape is evolving quickly. New technologies are creating new ways of moving money around, and new business models are emerging. There are also new players, including the big techs and the fintechs. And blockchain and distributed ledger technologies are opening up new possibilities. And as you all know, this innovation is raising many issues for people in the payments industry and for the regulators. This morning, I'd like to discuss some of these issues and their implications for the regulatory framework. I'll then discuss some of the Payment System Board's preliminary views from its review of retail payments regulation. The Payment System Board has a long-standing interest in promoting innovation in the Australian payment system. We've sought to do this through a mix of strategies. We've used a combination of first, suasion and pressure on industry participants to do better. Second, regulation to promote competition and access. Third, using our position to help overcome coordination problems that can act as a barrier to innovation in a network with many participants. And fourth, helping the industry establish benchmarks that can be aspired to collectively. I'll leave it to others to judge the success of this mix of strategies. But from my vantage point at least, Australians enjoy an efficient and dynamic payment system. There are still gaps that need addressing, but by global standards, we've done pretty well. Australians were early and rapid adapters of tap and go payments, and increasingly we're using digital wallets. We now have a very good fast payment system, which after a slow start is seeing continued strong volume growth. And there's a roadmap for the development of new payment capabilities using this fast payments infrastructure. So there's plenty of good news here. I would like though to draw your attention to two areas where we'd like to see more progress. The first is the move to electronic invoicing and the ability to link e-invoices to payments in a way that improves the efficiency of business processes. And the second is improvements in the speed, the cost, and the transparency of cross-border retail payments and international money transfers. In both these areas, we need to do more, and we're looking forward to progress on both of these fronts. Against the backdrop of this generally positive picture, the Payment System Board recognises that the structure of payment systems are changing. In some cases, it's now better to think of a payments ecosystem rather than a payments system. In this ecosystem, the payments chains can be longer and there can be more entities involved and new technologies are being used. This more complex and dynamic environment is opening up new possibilities for innovation, and it's also raising new competition issues to consider as well. One of the factors driving innovation is the increasing interest of technology-focused businesses in payments. These include the fintechs and the large multinational technology companies, often known as the big techs. They are both a source of innovation, and they're both playing a role in the development of digital wallets. These wallets are being used more frequently, and I expect that this trend has a long way to run yet. Another trend is the increasing use of payments within an app. Big techs are playing important roles on both of these fronts. This influence of the big techs is perhaps most evident in China, with Ant Group, owners of Alipay, and Tencent, owners of WeChat Pay, having developed new payments infrastructure, which has led to fundamental changes in how retail payments are made in China. In Australia and many other countries, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon are increasingly incorporating payments functionality into their service offerings. Mobile wallets such as Apple Pay and Google Pay are the most prominent examples of this in Australia. In some other countries, though, the big techs are also offering person-to-person transfers and consumer credit products. As we all are aware, Facebook announced its Libra project a couple of years ago. The Apple Pay and Google Pay wallets illustrate some of the new and complex issues that are arising. These wallets are clearly valued by consumers, and they will reduce industry-wide fraud costs through the use of fingerprints and facial recognition. The tokenization of the customer's card number is also a step forward. So these wallets are clearly good. They're good for innovation. At the same time, though, they're raising new competition issues. One of these relates to the restriction that Apple, unlike Google, places on access to the near-field communication technology on its devices. Many argue that this restriction limits the ability of other wallet providers to compete on these devices and that this could increase costs. This issue has recently attracted the attention of policymakers in several countries. For example, in 2019, the German Parliament passed a law requiring device manufacturers to provide third parties with access to technologies such as NFC that support payment services. And the European Commission announced in June that it would commence a formal antitrust investigation into Apple's restriction of third-party NFC access on the iOS device, and in September announced that it will consider legislation on third-party access. This issue has also been raised in submissions to our review of payment system regulation in Australia, and we're watching developments in Europe and elsewhere very closely. Another issue being raised by these wallets is the value of information and data. And again, we observe Google and Apple taking different approaches. Google states that it may collect information on transactions made using Google Pay, which can be used as part of providing or marketing other Google services to users. In contrast, Apple states that it does not collect transaction information that can be tied back to an individual Apple Pay user. There are also different approaches to charging transaction fees. Apple charges a fee to issuers when a transaction is made with the Apple Wallet, but a similar fee is not charged by Google when transactions are made with Google Pay. It's certainly possible that these different approaches to the use of data on the one hand and access and fees on the others are linked. So there are issues to consider here too. Beyond the issues raised by digital wallets, there are other competition issues raised by the involvement of the big tech companies in payments. These companies are mostly platform businesses that facilitate interactions between different types of users on the platform. They have very large user bases, benefiting from strong network effects that can make it hard for competitors. Data analysis is part of their DNA, and they become increasingly effective at commercializing the value of data that they collect and that they analyze. Providing additional services such as payments also reduces the need for users to leave the platform. So there are complex issues to be worked through here. One of these is the terms of access to the platform and whether the platform requires that payments be processed by the platform's own payment system. One specific issue is the nature of the protections that apply to any funds held within any new payments platform, especially when those funds are held outside the formal banking sector. For confidence in the system and for the protection of individuals and businesses, it's important that strong arrangements are in place here. In this regard, I welcome the government's announcement that will accept the Council of Financial Regulators' proposed reforms of regulatory arrangements, the so-called stored value facilities. Under the proposals, APRA and ASICS will be the primary regulator with requirements tailored to the nature of the facility. It would be possible, for example, to designate a provider of a stored value facility as being subject to APRA prudential supervision on the basis of financial safety considerations. This could become relevant if the technology companies were to launch new payments and other products that held significant customer funds outside the banking system. Internationally, this and related issues came to prominence following Facebook's announcement that it was developing a global stablecoin, originally known as Libra, but recently rebranded as Diem. Since the original announcement, the Libra Association has also announced plans to launch some single currency stablecoins intended for use in consumer digital wallets. In April, the association applied to FINMA the Swiss financial regulator for a payments license. This initiative has raised concerns from governments and regulators in many jurisdictions, including Australia. These concerns relate to consumer protection, financial stability, money laundering, and privacy and data. The Swiss authorities have established a regulatory college to coordinate with other countries. The RBA is participating in this college on behalf of the Australian Council of Financial Regulators. FINMA has indicated that DM will be subject to the principle of same risks, same rules. If it poses bank-like risks, it will be subject to bank-like regulatory requirements. So it remains to be seen how this and other similar arrangements progress. As I said at the outset, the world of payments is becoming more complex, and it's raising new issues for industry participants and regulators to deal with. This means that it is timely to consider how the payment system should be regulated, and the payment system welcomes the government's review of the regulatory architecture. The legislation governing the Reserve Bank's regulatory responsibilities in the payments area was put in place over 20 years ago. This legislation gives the bank specific powers in relation to payment systems and participants in those systems. While the powers are quite broad, in practice, the bank has the ability to regulate only a fairly limited range of participants. As I mentioned earlier, these regulatory powers have been used in conjunction with our ability to persuade and to help solve coordination problems in the payment system. As part of a government's review, it is worth considering what the right balance is here, and whether the regulatory arrangements could be modified to better address the complexities of our modern payments ecosystem. At the same time that we've been considering these broad issues, the Payment System Board has been conducting its periodic review of retail payments regulation in Australia. This review was temporarily put on hold during the pandemic, but it's now restarted. I'd like to use this opportunity to provide you with a sense of our thinking on three important issues: the interchange fee regulation, dual network debit cards and least cost routing, and the third one is the buy now, pay later, no surcharge rules. I want to stress that we have not yet reached any final conclusions, and the bank staff will be meeting with industry participants over the next few months to discuss these and other issues. If at the conclusion of the review, we are to make further changes to the standards, it's our intention to consult on these by mid next year. On interchange, the board's view is that these fees should generally be as low as possible, especially in mature payment systems. While these fees might arguably play a role in establishing a new payment method, once a payment system is well established, these fees do increase the cost of payments for merchants, and they can distort payment choices. So the direction of change in these fees over the medium term should be down and not up. Having said that, at the current point in time, the board does not see a strong case for a significant revision of the interchange framework in Australia. The current interchange standards have been in effect for only 3.5 years, and submissions to the review did not point to strong arguments for major changes now. The standards appear to be working well, and we recognise that frequent regulatory change can carry costs. It's also relevant that the average level of interchange rates in Australia is quite low by international standards, particularly the 8 cents benchmark for debit card payments. Credit card interchange fees are also lower than many other countries. One exception to this is the lower credit card interchange fees in Europe. The board is watching the European experience closely, and it expects that over time, a stronger case will emerge for lower credit card interchange fees in Australia. There's one aspect of the interchange regulations where the board is considering a change as part of this review, and that is the cap on the fees that can be applied to any particular category. Currently, a 20 basis point cap applies when a fee is expressed in percentage terms, and a cap of 15 cents applies when the fee is expressed in terms of cents. The board sees a case to lower this 15 cents cap. This case has emerged as being an increasing tendency for interchange fees on transactions to be set at the 15 cents cap, particularly on transactions that are less at risk of being routed to the other schemes. At the same time, the international schemes are setting much lower strategic rates for some merchants, particularly larger ones, in response to least cost routing. This is resulting in large difference in interchange fees on debit cards being paid on similar transactions, with unreasonably high interchange fees on some low-value transactions, especially at smaller merchants. For example, a 15-cent interchange fee on a $5 transaction is equivalent to an interchange rate of 300 basis points, which is far higher than would apply to if the transaction was on a credit card. So over the coming months, bank staff will be seeking further information from the industry on this issue as the board considers a lower cap here. The second issue that I'd like to talk about is dual network debit cards and least cost routing. The board has long held the position that merchants should have the freedom and the capability to route debit card transactions through the lower cost network. The government and a wide range of stakeholders have a similar view. It's understandable why. This choice promotes competition and helps keep downward pressure on the costs of goods and services for the community. Over recent years, the board has discussed the right balance between regulation and suasion to achieve this outcome. Its judgment has been that the best approach was for the industry itself to support least cost routing, pushed along by pressure from the RBA. While progress has been slower than we would have liked, the slow progress by the major banks did create competitive openings for other players, which did lead to some innovation. The major banks now also all offer least cost routing, with some making it the default offering for small and medium-sized businesses. So over time, there has been significant progress. The board is not convinced that a better outcome would have been achieved through regulation. The concept of least cost routing is most applicable when a physical card is used and when the card has two networks on it. One recent trend that we've observed is that some issuers have sought to move away from dual network debit cards to issue single network cards, often with no FBOSS functionality. This may be partly in response to financial incentives from the international schemes and possibly the additional cost to issuers from supporting two networks on a card. Notwithstanding this trend, the board's view is that it is in the public interest for dual network cards to continue to be the main form of debit card issued in Australia. It's also important that acquirers and other payment providers offer or support least cost routing, and that the schemes do not act in a way that inappropriately discourages merchants from adopting least cost routing. So the board is again considering the best balance between regulation and suasion to achieve these outcomes. Consistent with its earlier approach, the board's preference is for the industry to deliver these outcomes without regulation. And to help achieve this, the board is considering setting out some formal expectations in this area. If these expectations are not met, the board would then consider regulation. So to be clear, the board sees a strong case for all larger issuers of debit cards to issue cards with two networks on them. At the same time, it recognises that there can be additional costs of supporting two networks, which can make it harder for new entrants and small institutions to be competitive. So it may not be appropriate to expect very small issuers to issue such cards. Over the months ahead, the bank staff will be consulting with small ADIs and the schemes to get a clearer picture of the costs and the implications for determining any regulatory expectations here, particularly for the small institutions. The board also expects that in the point of sale or device present environment, all acquirers should provide merchants with the ability to implement least cost routing for contactless transactions, possibly on an opt-out basis. In the online or the device not present environment, it's not yet clear how least cost routing should operate and what expectations on its provision might be appropriate. In this environment, there's scope for consumers to make more active choices. There are various technical challenges to least cost routing, and there can be more providers in the payments chain, so it's more complicated. So the idea of how least cost routing might apply in the online world is going to be explored by the bank staff over coming months. The third and the final issue that I'd like to cover is the no surcharge rules of the buy now, pay later providers. The board's long-standing view is that the right of merchants to apply a surcharge promotes payment system competition and keeps downward pressure on payments costs for businesses. This is especially so when merchants consider that it's near essential to take a particular payment method for them to be competitive. The board also recognises that it is possible that no surcharge rules can play a role in the development of new payment methods. While new payment methods can clearly be developed without them, these rules can, under some circumstances, make it easier to build a network, and so they can promote innovation and entry. The board's preliminary view is that the buy now, pay later operators in Australia have not yet reached the point where it's clear that the costs arising from the no surcharge rule outweigh the potential benefits in terms of innovation. So, consistent with its philosophy of only regulating when it's clear that doing so is in the public interest, the board is unlikely to conclude that the buy now, pay later operators should be required to remove their no surcharge rules right now. Even the largest buy now, pay later providers still account for only a small proportion of total consumer payments in Australia, that's notwithstanding their rapid growth. New business models are also emerging, including some that facilitate payments using virtual cards issued under the designated card schemes and that are subject to the existing surcharging framework. In addition, the increasing array of buy now, pay later providers is resulting in competitive pressure that could put downward pressure on merchant costs. Having said this, the board expects that over time, a public policy case is likely to emerge for the removal of the no surcharge rules in at least some of these arrangements. Some operators are growing very rapidly and they're becoming widely adopted by merchants, particularly in certain sectors. As part of the bank's ongoing consideration of this issue, the staff will be discussing with industry participants possible criteria or thresholds for determining when no surcharge rules should no longer be allowed for the buy now, pay later providers. If the point is reached where the board's view is that the public interest would be served by the removal of a no surcharge rule, the board's preference would be to reach a voluntary agreement with the relevant provider. This would be similar to the approach adopted with American Express and PayPal. In the event that this were not possible, the bank would discuss with the Australian government the best way to address this issue. More broadly, as I discussed earlier, the current Treasury review of the regulatory architecture provides an opportunity to look holistically at this issue and whether the existing legislation and regulatory provisions could be amended to better reflect our modern and dynamic payments ecosystem. So that is a quick review of some of the issues that the Payment System Board and the RBA staff have been focusing on recently. It's clear that payments is an increasingly exciting and complex area, and significant innovations are occurring. This presents opportunities to deliver improved services to end users of the payment system, as well as raising new questions for policymakers, including the Reserve Bank. In this context, the Reserve Bank very much appreciates the ongoing engagement we have with the industry, and we look forward working together in the interest of promoting better outcomes for the Australian community. Thank you very much, Andy, and I'm happy to answer some questions.
Thank you so much, Governor. We've got a few questions in by chat already. We did turn the chat function off because it was proving a bit distracting. So if you've been storing your questions up, please now, the chat will be reopened shortly. Please do now raise them. There's a bit of a COVID flavour to the ones that I have already, Phil, but I'll start with a couple that are on your remarks. One from Steve Price, noting that you mentioned e-invoicing as a key area of focus. And just wondering what some of the key challenges are that the bank are observing there. I might generalise that. You mentioned e-invoicing and cross-border retail payments. Maybe any of the key challenges that you see there?
The key challenges, I think the key challenges are generic, really, to innovation in networks. It's getting everyone to agree on the best way forward. Now, there's no disagreement that we need a better invoicing and e-payment system. Australia, the government is certainly pushing this for small and medium-sized businesses. The issue is how we get there. The same set of issues are arising in international transfers. At the meetings that I used to go to in Basel and now do by video conference late in the evening, one of the most common issues outside the economy that's discussed is everyone needs to do better on cross-border transfers. This is one area that of the payment system globally that the banks have not done a good enough job on, and the costs are still too high, payments take too long, they're too complicated. And in that environment, it's not surprising that the big techs and the fintechs are finding openings where they can come through and offer potentially a better service to consumers. In the international discussions, these solving network problems are even more difficult because you're dealing with not just the participants in one payment system, but the participants in many payment systems. So the common challenge to all these innovations is finding the right business model, getting the agreement, how it can be done. And so the work of AusPayNet and the Australian Payments Council are kind of critical here. I notice one of the five focus areas of the Australian Payments Council is innovation and cross-border payments. So I think, you know, it can be done. It needs to be done. We just need to find the right governance mechanism to get it done.
And the Financial Stability Board has obviously laid out its roadmap for the next 5 years on that topic of cross-border, which we're looking at very closely.
Everyone knows it has to be done. The central banks know that this is one area where collectively our actions and the actions of the private banks are not delivering adequately for people who need to make cross-border payments. It's, if I can just go on a bit here, that it's a particular issue in the South Pacific. Just participated in a meeting of the governors of the South Pacific Central Banks, and it's the number one issue that they want to discuss, particularly with some of the Australian banks withdrawing from the market, and the Reserve Bank of Australia and Reserve Bank of New Zealand are collectively working on something here to develop a stronger KYC utility. It's a first-order issue for many people, so we need to do better.
Thank you, Governor. Another question related to digital currency, which, of course, was the topic of your address a couple of years ago at this summit. The question is, what events will give rise to the bank changing the position that it's had so far, that there is not a strong case for a central bank digital currency and commencing a pilot for a retail CBDC?
What event would lead us to change? I don't think there's a specific event. I think that we're watching what's going on overseas very carefully. So if there were to be a large-scale retail central bank digital currency developed in part of the world and was successful, we would clearly look at that. I'd have to say that there's still a lot of skepticism in most of the central banking community about this, particularly in countries like Australia, where we already have a first-class banking system and a very good payment system that allows people to move money around very quickly. If a country doesn't have a really strong payment system, I think the interest in this is stronger. But we do have a very good payment system. It has some gaps, and if the gaps are not filled, then other solutions will come in to address those gaps. But by and large, we have a good payment system. So I don't see the need for a central bank digital currency. The other concerns that are on the central banking list are really the implications of a central bank digital currency for the structure of the financial system and for financial stability. Just imagine a world in which the central bank issued a liability that people could easily invest in other than banknotes. Especially in a low interest rate world, people might want to hold their savings in the liability issued by the central bank rather than liability issued by the private bank. So he could see a flow of money out of the banks into the central bank, and then we would have a large balance sheet which had to be managed, and that could potentially change the structure of the financial system. The other concern is financial stability. One, in a time of difficulty where there was stress in the banking system, at the moment you can take your money out of the bank or the banking system, but you've got to take it into banknotes, and that's kind of has some natural limitations. It's inconvenient, and you've got to store the banknotes securely. If you could take your money out of the private bank and just invest in a liability issued by the central bank in a time of crisis, you could make the deposit base of the banking system less stable, creating new financial stability risks. So you ask what would change our views, successful implementation somewhere else in the world and a way to deal with these issues about financial stability and changing fundamentally the structure of our financial system. Australia is in a good position because we've got a very good payment system, so we don't need to confront this, but we'll see what happens in other countries, and China's probably going to be in the vanguard here.
Thank you. Thank you, Governor. A question about BNPL. In your remarks, you uniquely described the thinking around the no surcharge rule and the benefits versus costs balance. The question from Rob Menon is what level of BNPL market share or other factors would be required before you would start looking at regulation around the no surcharging rule and removing that?
Well, that's something that we are going to consult on over the coming months. We don't have a strong view about what the thresholds might be. I think at a higher level, the principle is a particular payment method a must-take in large parts of the economy? I think if merchants feel like they really must take this particular payment method, then the argument for allowing them to have a surcharge if the costs are too high to them, that becomes quite strong. So I think the credit cards for many businesses are must take, debit cards are must take. So we think it's appropriate that those schemes do not have a no surcharge rule. When the buy now, pay later schemes become sufficiently large, that merchants feel, not just in one subsector, but a number of sectors, when they feel it's this, they must take them. And I think the public policy case is there to have those schemes remove those rules. What the thresholds are, we'll be discussing with you and others over coming months. And then if, as I said in the prepared remarks, if we reached the point where we thought that it was in the public interest for these rules to be removed, we'd have to do that in conjunction with the government. It's not a matter just that the payment system board could deal with itself, I think. Given the particular nature of the legislation that we operate under, we'd probably be looking for, we would be looking to work with the government to deal with this.
Understood, thank you. Couple of questions coming in which are inspired by your earlier comments on the questions on CBDC and cross-border payments. One that links the two from Dave Birch, would a digital wallet or CBDC help to attack the problem of remittances and overseas payments?
It would depend upon how it was designed. I mean, when Facebook first proposed Libra, part of the selling of this was it would help address the frictions in cross-border payments. So it's possible, but I think it does need, under one configuration, it does need the various payment systems across countries to be linked up. That's some work the central banks could be doing. Another is for money to be held outside the banking system in accounts at a big tech, and then you can move money between these different currency accounts easily. So if you're operating within the platform, then I can see a way that this could be done quite easily. If you're conducting a transaction with someone who isn't on the platform, I think it's more difficult, because then you need to move money between platforms. How does that work? I'm not so sure. I guess there's a way, but I'm not sure what it is. So it may. I think if we do see a world where large balances, particularly in multi-currencies, are held on the platforms outside the formal banking sector, the protections that are given to that money are going to be critical. Because if people are deciding to hold lots of money on a platform, not just for small transactions, but large balances, then we've got to make sure that the balances held on that platform are secure and people have confidence that they can get them back. As we know, going back through hundreds of years, the history of private money is a history of littered with many problems. It works okay for a while, but then whenever there's any stress in the system, people run from private money back to money backed by the state. Understandable, and that's why in every country, the currency is backed by money, you know, banknotes are backed by the state and not privately. So it can work well for a while, but when stress happens, the people want money backed by the state. So it's kind of, we can ensure it's possible to develop technical solutions that reduce the frictions in cross-border payments, but we've got to do it in a way that's going to be consistent with sustainable financial stability as well. And this is why the discussions that we're having with our Swiss colleagues and at FINMA, financial stability is kind of a central part of that. We want a system that works well for consumers in the good times and in the bad times.
Indeed. So a question here from Soumya Srinivasan, harking back to your speech at last year's summit, and noting you mentioned there the potential for the consolidation of FPOS, NPP, and BPAY. Do you have any further thoughts on that a year on?
Not particularly. Notice there's been progress, faster progress than I had expected. We're an observer to this process, really. It's really up to the industry and ultimately the competition authorities to come up with something that's in the public interest. If one issue that I will be paying close attention to is the terms of reference or the mandate or the constitution of any merged entity, we really want to see that have a strong public interest focus rather than a private interest. I'm not close enough to the discussions to know what the constitution looks like, but one of the issues I'll be looking at is making sure that what we use whatever influence we can that has a public interest mandate. And then it'll be up to the industry and the competition authorities to see whether this is in the public good. I can see it could help solve many of the coordination problems that we all know about in our networks. Some people have an alternative perspective and say it could reduce competition and innovation. So it's really up to the industry and the ACCC to balance those two things, and we don't have any particular role here.
Thank you. I noted there was a COVID flavour to some of the questions. I'll come on to a couple of those now, Governor. So the first one from Sophie Ellsworth as New Court. Noting that COVID-19 has fast-tracked the fall in cash usage, although I'd note not banknotes in circulation. So does that mean Australia will eventually be a cashless society?
I don't think we're going to get to the point of being a cashless society. We will have a society with less cash in it. It's been interesting this year, as you say, the kind of use of banknotes for transaction purposes declined a lot. You see that in the big drop in ATM withdrawals. But the stock of currency on issue relative to GDP is the highest that it's ever been, or at least in 50 or 60 years. This year, we've seen very, very strong demand for 50s and $100 notes. In the first days of the pandemic, it was, I think people were nervous. They were taking, some people were taking their money out of the bank, a bit like we saw in the GFC, although it wasn't on the same magnitude. That settled down pretty quickly. And over recent months, I think many, as best we can tell, and this is what the banks tell us, many people were taking out a few hundred dollars extra to keep at home, just in case something went wrong. They got locked. There was a lockdown, and they wanted to make sure they had some kind of cash that they could use to buy the basic necessities. So many of us are keeping a few hundred dollars at home. And so the stock of notes on issue has gone up again. In time, I'd expect those notes to come back into the system, come out of the system and come back to the Reserve Bank. But probably the other point to make here is that cash still has an important role to play as a emergency payment method. I think we've all heard stories where a bank's systems have gone down, a merchant's internet isn't working, they can't do a transaction in the electronic system for something and we want to make a payment. In almost every case, you can be guaranteed that you can use cash to make the payment. Not every case, but almost every case. And so many people will still, I think, want to hold cash. As I talked about last year, if the electronic system was more resilient, that would probably take away the desire, at least some people, to hold $50 or $100 in their wallet or purse in case something went wrong. But we need a payment system that can work when the electronic system isn't working, and cash is the best one so far. Another one might emerge, but at the moment, cash is the best one.
Thank you, Governor. The other COVID-related question, and probably given the time, our last question, is around how COVID tracing has brought QR codes into everyday life, and whether you have a view on whether, and if so, what the future of QR codes in Australian payments might look like?
I don't have a particular view on that. Again, it's something for the industry to examine. The Reserve Bank and the Payment System Board doesn't have a particular view here. From the discussions we've had in the past, my takeaway is the issue was security. If that can be adequately addressed, then this can work well for consumers, but we've got to have a payment system that's, and I talked about this last year, resilient and secure. And whether the QR codes offer enough security, with given the advances in technology, I'm not close enough to the issue to know. But it's not something that we have a particular view on at the moment.
Thank you. We probably have time for one more. Just reflecting back to your remarks about NFC, just a question there about whether you think Australia might follow the EU and German regulatory positions about the impact of competition on potentially restricted access to NFC.
Again, this is not an issue for the Payment System Board directly. We can, under current legislation, regulate a payment system and the participants in the system. My understanding is our regulatory powers do not extend to how an NFC device is accessed. So this could become an issue for the ACCC, and it may be one of the issues the government considers as part of its payment system review. I think if Europe were to move on this issue successfully, then it'd be something that we should seriously consider as well. Apple obviously has counter arguments, particularly around security and access to the device. So there's another perspective here as well. But we'll be watching, as I said earlier, what happens in Europe very carefully here.
I'll now call this session to a close. Thank you again, Governor. I wish everybody on the call an excellent festive season, and goodbye.
Goodbye, and thank you.